COVID-19 put the world on hold in 2020, and the United States fared particularly poorly during the pandemic. There were numerous missed opportunities and sociopolitical vulnerabilities that led to this epic tragedy. One missed opportunity that has loomed especially large has been confusion around airborne spread of the virus. Precautions such as improving indoor air quality or wearing masks were ignored or downplayed until far too late. Experts at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, or CDC, and at the World Health Organization, or WHO, instead emphasized distancing 3 to 6 feet apart and hand washing. It turned out that they were basing information on the spread of the virus on a false binary between large droplets that infect people in close contact and tiny particles called aerosols that can float in the air for longer periods of time, and so be breathed in by people further away. I'm Katie Burke, Digital Features Editor at American Scientist, and in this episode of the American Scientist podcast, I speak with Virginia Tech environmental engineer Lindsay Marr. Her expertise in aerosols came to center stage as she and her colleagues worked for years to change policies based on faulty ideas about the transmission of the coronavirus. So how did you start working on airborne transmission?
Yeah, I started working on airborne transmission in around 2009. And what I mainly been studying kind of outdoor air pollution, particle emissions from vehicles. And then what got me interested, it was I kind of had a longstanding interest in biological particles in the air, what we call bioaerosols, things like bacteria. And what really got me interested in airborne transmission was that I had a baby in the end of 2008, 2007, and then he started daycare when he was about 1 year old, so starting in 2009. And of course, as with all kids who start daycare, he got sick a lot. It felt like every week. It was probably every other week. And so we'd get the phone call, like, your son is sick, you have to come pick him up. And so my husband or I would go pick him up. And, you know, if I went to pick him up, I'd find out, oh, half the kids are out at the same time. And it was really impressive that so many kids could get sick all at once. And it was very frustrating to me, of course, that my kid got sick and I upended my work schedule. The daycare center had really good, what we consider hygiene practices. Like, they required everyone to wash their hands when they came in, and they were washing their hands all the time and wiping down surfaces. And, you know, if a kid put a toy in their mouth, they would take it out of circulation and put it into what they called the yucky bucket for cleaning and sterilization. And, you know, in some cases, the kids, we think of little kids as being all over each other, but, you know, a lot of times they weren't necessarily. And so I started to wonder it seems like everyone's getting sick all at the same time. Is it something that's spreading through the air? And so then I started doing some reading about how flus and colds were spread, and I was surprised to learn that we didn't actually know at a mechanistic level, like the way that I think about particle pollution spreading through the air, we didn't actually know how the viruses were getting from one person to the other. There was the idea that they were coming out in these large wet droplets that people would cough or sneeze onto each other. But frankly, there wasn't a lot of evidence for that. And they were missing out on the fact that people also release very much tinier droplets, like aerosol particles that you can't see, that could potentially contain the virus. So the first thing we did was to go into a daycare center, the University Health Center, and get samples on airplanes, where we collected particles from the air, and we knew what size they were, and we found the flu virus in these very tiny particles just floating around in the air. So not near a sick person, but just in the air in half our samples.
Wow. Yeah. My daughter just started daycare too, so I completely relate with what you're seeing. It's been completely different with having a baby during a pandemic, though. Tell me about the early days of the pandemic. So you had been studying airborne transmission for a while, and so when this hit, what were you starting to think about as you were starting to hear the first news about COVID-19?
Yeah, when we first heard about it in, December of 2019, and it was identified as a severe acute respiratory virus 2, so SARS-1, the original one from, 2003 and 4, it was pretty well established that was transmitted through the airborne route. And so, you know, my first assumption was that, well, this there's no reason why this wouldn't be too. And so I kind of assumed that. And then seeing what was happening with a rapid spread in China, and them really clamping down on things, locking down, and then also seeing photos of healthcare workers in China in the hospitals where they were wearing full, you know, protective gear that you wouldn't go to the trouble of wearing unless this virus were very transmissible. And then, yeah, it was those things kind of tipped me off that, yeah, well, this is probably airborne too. And so, you know, in January I was thinking, yeah, this is probably airborne. And then what really clinched it for me was the Skagit Valley Corral outbreak in early March, you know, in Washington State. And, oh, I would say, you know, at this time, I also knew that there was, that the kind of the traditional thinking in medical and public health circles is that this would be transmitted by, you know, large droplets when people are close to each other, coughing on each other within 6 feet. And there was like a New York Times article that was published in the end of January, and it was something about six things that are important for kind of understanding what's going to happen with the spread of this virus. And one of them was, one of the questions was, well, how far does the virus travel? And they said, well, this one only doesn't travel very far, unlike measles and some others that can travel hundreds of feet or more. And I thought this was totally wrong. And I replied to that tweet and said, you know, I don't believe this. Why do people think this? So that was the end of January. And then I knew, kind of seeing things evolving throughout February, it was clear that the U.S. medical community and public health communities were, you know, doubling down on this idea of it's spreading just through these large droplets, not more than 6 feet. We need to worry about contaminated surfaces. And I had my doubts. And then the Skagit Valley Corral outbreak in early March really, again, really clinched it for me that, you know, this is airborne for sure.
What was it about that outbreak that made you think that? Was it the rapidity of by which it spread, or?
Yeah, it was the fact that the people going into that practice, the rehearsal, knew that this virus was there, and so they took some precautions. They avoided shaking hands, they kind of spaced themselves out. And nevertheless, over 50 of 60 people, I think, became infected at that one rehearsal. And they were singing, you know, vocalizing a lot. Even if they shared food, or let's say everyone touched the same doorknob, the idea that that doorknob or whatever object could become contaminated by one person, and then that you could have 50 people come by and subsequently touch that same object, and that there's still virus on it after the first few people touch it, I just found to be unbelievable.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember having similar thoughts, you know? I mean, I'm not an expert. I know that the people at CDC and WHO are very smart and highly trained. And, you know, I have a background in disease ecology, but it's not what I do now. And, you know, I remember seeing these outbreaks and the choruses and the cruise ship, and just thinking 6 feet isn't gonna cut it. And so can you walk me through, you'd already been working with this, why was this an entrenched idea, and what was keeping people from, what was really keeping people from making, I mean, some of the people must have been aware that 6 feet wasn't going to be truly completely effective, or, you know, I
don't know. I think this is what, you know, was the truth in the medical community. And that was the understanding about infectious disease transmission, because it was based on observations of what happened, who became sick. And so they would, you know, you'd see an outbreak, and then they would look for so-called close contacts, people who were, you know, near, in close proximity to the infected person, and they would find, oh yeah, these people became sick. The thing is that the way their contact tracing was defined, they didn't really look at other people who were maybe in the room, but not closely associated with the infected person. So it's like, they weren't looking for it, and so they didn't see it. And then another thing is that I think a lot of understanding of infectious disease transmission grew out of what happens in hospitals. And so, of course, they knew that, yeah, you shouldn't be, you know, touch one patient and then go touch another for some diseases. You know, that obviously is bad. But also modern hospitals are pretty well ventilated. And so under those conditions, you're less likely to see airborne transmission. And if people are wearing medical masks, surgical masks, you know, that doesn't completely block it, but it would help reduce it. And so, and I think people just weren't aware that, you know, they could see these large, wet, visible droplets. And so, yeah, it's easy to understand that those could carry virus and could transmit it. But, you know, for every one of those, there's hundreds of these tiny particles that you can't see. And so they didn't know they were there and didn't realize that this could be happening. And so I think a lot of the ideas about disease transmission were based on, again, observations of who gets sick, well, the people who are nearby, and then combined with, oh, we see these large droplets, so that's what's transmitting the disease. And so they, you know, again, they weren't aware of these smaller particles and weren't looking at people who were farther away. And, you know, I would argue that that's fine. That's what their expertise lies in. And, you know, medical people, researchers, and MDs are experts on what's happening with a pathogen when it's inside your body. I have no expertise in that. You know, once it gets to your body, I don't know what happens. But if you're thinking about what happens to that pathogen when it's outside your body, and in the indoor environment or outdoor environment, I would argue that, you know, an environmental engineer or aerosol scientist is an expert in what is happening, or has the right expertise to try to understand what is happening with that pathogen virus, and it's moving around between people. And so that's where I think my expertise and others comes into play and is important and wasn't really recognized until the pandemic.
So can you clarify the technical meaning of the terms droplets and aerosols and why there were particular terms that CDC and WHO were unwilling to use at first?
Right. So in kind of the traditional definitions of disease transmission, droplet, the word droplet referred to things that were larger than a certain size, and they specified a cutoff of 5 or 10 microns, and that were assumed to travel kind of ballistically, like following a certain trajectory as they came out of one person's mouth or nose and then flew through the air and landed in someone else's eyes or nose or mouth, or landed on a surface and contaminated. And that was, again, thought to be the major way that the colds and flus were transmitted. And then there were also aerosols, which were defined to be smaller than that cutoff. And those were thought to transmit mainly at long distance. And diseases such as measles and tuberculosis were acknowledged to be transmitted by aerosols or to be airborne. So this definition of airborne transmission was very much associated with a certain size particle, smaller than a certain size, and at long distance. But the big blind spot they had in those definitions is that when you have these very small particles, yes, they can transmit at long distance, but they can also transmit at close distance. So when people are close to each other, they're actually even more likely to be exposed to these small particles, because when they're coming out of your mouth, you could imagine like a cigarette smoke. It's like someone's smoking a cigarette. You have these tiny particles in the air. Yes, they can travel a long distance, but you are much more likely to breathe a lot more of those particles if you're close to the person. And so that's kind of where I think the problem in the definitions came about. Yeah, so that's how kind of WHO and CDC and medical textbooks had defined transmission. And then there was one other route they called fomites, or kind of indirect contact, where, you know, somebody would touch a contaminated object, or the object would become contaminated by droplets falling on it. Someone would go touch it and then pick up the virus and then put their fingers in their eyes, nose, or mouth and get the disease.
It also seems like that the division of that into a binary, it just doesn't quite make sense. I understand that from a policy perspective, you often have to create categories, but, you know.
Yeah, it was very much this binary, and the way that the infectious disease or infection prevention and control community defined it. It was very binary. A disease was either droplet or it was airborne. It was one or the other. But in reality, what's happening when people are in close proximity is that it could be either of these routes, either the large droplets flying into someone's eyes, nose, or mouth, or it could be, you know, the aerosol particles that the person is breathing when they're close to the infected person.
Before the pandemic, were you already working to change the policies on airborne transmission? That it was something that you knew was a problem, but was that already something you were trying to do, or did that really ramp up once the pandemic?
It was something I brought up a few times, and other people who have expertise in this area had brought up, but we were pretty ignored, and I would say ridiculed even in some cases, because, you know, we're outsiders to the field, and so, you know, they thought, oh, what do these people know? They have no idea. This is how it's been defined for 50 years. This is just the way it is. So yeah, so we it was kind of like shouting into the void. We were ignored. But then obviously this became much more critical with the pandemic, because if we continue to focus on droplets and just staying 6 feet away and wiping down surfaces, I didn't think we were going to control the disease very well. Well, it was obvious. And so I became much more vocal at that point. And then really it was Lydia Maroska in Australia, and also an expert in this field, who kind of pulled together a group of researchers worldwide who have expertise in this, mostly not MDs, but have expertise in, you know, how pathogens move around in the environment, and then she led several efforts to kind of, you know, publish a paper with, we had 239 co-signers on this, to kind of really a letter directed to the WHO, public letter saying, hey, this is what is happening. We're pretty sure this is what's happening. You know, you need to update your science to so that we can control this, try to control the spread better.
So when did that first push happen? When did that group come together?
She pulled us together and arranged a meeting with the WHO in early of April. Okay. But even before that, someone, you know, a collaborator and I had written a commentary, a perspective, kind of emphasizing the importance of airborne transmission in March, and tried to submit that to journals and got rejected.
Maybe walk me through the beats of what happened over the course of the next couple of years until policies really did start changing. What are sort of the major events that you kind of see as...
Yeah, so I'll try to remember that. So in April of 2020, you know, Lydia Maroska arranged the meeting with the WHO, and they, I would say they met with us. I don't think they wanted to hear what we had to say. And so she led the letter that was published in July in Clinical Infectious Disease, and it kind of took WHO by surprise, and I think they responded to it and said, oh, well, you know, we acknowledge that airborne transmission can happen in special circumstances. For example, when there's these, what they call aerosol-generating medical procedures taking place in healthcare settings where you're intubating someone or doing certain things that they thought could generate aerosols. I think they just were not aware that when people breathe and talk, they're generating aerosols, actually more than are generated through these medical procedures. Or they said, yeah, in special circumstances it could happen. And then in August of 2020, there was a National Academies workshop on airborne transmission of SARS-CoV-2. And we presented evidence, various experts spoke at that, presented evidence for airborne transmission. And it was a very strong case at that point. And from that workshop, we ended up, Kim Prather, who's a professor at UC San Diego, led a letter or commentary in Science where it was called Airborne Transmission of SARS-CoV-2. And we kind of summarized the findings from the workshop and in 300 words, published that in October of 2020. And we let CDC know that this was coming. And in response, they temporarily changed their website information about transmission, but then it went back. So this was weird. And then, let's see, after that, I think the next major event was that in the following spring of 2021, there were three papers published the same week in major medical journals. So Journal of the American Medical Association, The Lancet, and British Medical Journal, BMJ, by various groups about, you know, airborne transmission. Like, here it's happening, and, you know, here's what we need to do about it. And so I think at that point, the message really broke through, because these papers were published in highly respected medical journals. And so the medical community could no longer just ignore it, right? Because you don't tend to pay attention to the journals that are outside your field. And so I think that was around that time, I think CDC soon after that kind of adjusted their website and put airborne or aerosol transmission at the top of the list of how it's transmitted. And then later that year, WHO finally changed its scientific information also to be in line with this. Like, okay, yeah, this is probably the dominant way it's transmitted. But they didn't really publicize that change very well. It's almost like they tried to do it under the radar on December 24th, like the day before Christmas. No one's paying attention. Slipped it through, didn't say anything about it. And yet at the same time, they still have this tweet saying, oh, you know, COVID-19 is not airborne. And I think they're trying to talk out of both sides of their mouth at the same time. I think they acknowledge the science. At the same time, airborne is like this magic word in hospitals. If you say a disease is airborne, it means that you need respirators for all healthcare workers, airborne infection isolation rooms or negative pressure rooms for patients. And that is very expensive. And a lot of hospitals just don't have the capacity to do that for the number of patients that they were getting. And so WHO did not want to put hospitals in a bad position where they would not be able to provide the care that is expected if you have a, quote, airborne disease.
Yeah, it's such a shame. In a way, they were thinking so much about hospitals, which I understand. I mean, you know, hospitals were going through so much, but so were people in schools and daycares and all of these other places, gyms, you know, where they needed, you know, better guidelines. It's unfortunate that you know, that terminology had carried such weight. And I can understand, you know, I guess maybe can you talk a little bit more about where that resistance comes from? I mean, how much was it that the people at making these decisions at WHO and CDC didn't want to be wrong? Was there concern about, you know, about just, you know, availability of these, you know, protocols that were going to have to be put in place if you use the term airborne? Was there concern about liability or something like that?
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but my impression is that there was a lot of concern about acknowledging airborne transmission because of the implications it would have for healthcare, and that, you know, if you say a disease is airborne, then you need these extra precautions, which are costly and perhaps not available. And, you know, I know from CDC that they will not make a recommendation if the goods, the materials are not available. So early on in the pandemic, they were not going to recommend respirators for people, even if they wanted to, because their respirators were simply not available. We didn't even have enough for our healthcare workers at that point. Right? They were sterilizing and reusing them. And so there was that thing. I imagine, and this is just, you know, kind of seeing how the world works, that liability would be a big issue too for healthcare workers who got sick on the job. If the disease were acknowledged to be airborne, then the employer is responsible for providing respiratory protection for the employees. And so then if the workers get sick, then the employer is liable for that. So yeah, I think that was probably a big driver of resistance by the healthcare industry, let's say, about using the word airborne, saying that, mm-hmm. saying that the disease was airborne.
Mm-hmm. And you said respirators weren't available. Do you mean N95s in particular?
Yeah. So early on, right, there were not enough N95s.
Yeah. So then, like, how long did it take to change policy on airborne transmission or aerosols and also to get better guidelines on ventilation and physical distancing to the extent that we have those now?
I don't remember the exact timeline. I think sometime in 2021, CDC added, kind of reorganized its guidance for the public about transmission and started talking about ventilation. WHO has a really nice document on ventilation also, but I think it was, yeah, sometimes toward in 2021, finally, that they started providing guidance about ventilation, placed less emphasis maybe on wiping down surfaces, but there's still a lot on hand washing, and that's still the message, I think, that a lot of the public remembers, you know, 6 feet and hand washing. Then there were, of course, all kinds of political issues about masking. So things, you know, I think the guidance gradually changed, but people had already kind of heard the initial messages, and I think there wasn't a big campaign to help people recognize the change in policy in guidance. And then kind of the whole mask, you know, masks had been kind of politically poisoned, and you know, I think that the guidance is there now, and eventually the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy kind of tried to promote kind of awareness of ventilation and, well, virus transmission and ventilation, and that was in, kind of the end of, end of 2021 and beginning of 2022, maybe. Somewhere in there that the White House started talking about this, too.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, it's all kind of blurring together.
I know, it's got to be a blur. I guess one thing I'm also thinking about is, like, you know, I mean, it must have been, like, how did you feel going through all of this? I mean, it must have been so disheartening and frustrating. You know, people were dying while all of this was happening.
I was exhausted because I was working a lot of hours for 2 years, and I was doing 10 interviews a week for a couple of years, media interviews on top of, you know, everything else I was trying to do. And I was incredibly frustrated because I knew how the virus was getting around, and it was just not, you just couldn't argue with it. I mean, it's just physics. Like, the apple falls from the tree. Okay, this is what happens when virus comes out in particles of certain sizes. And so it was just very frustrating for me to know this and to have to fight so hard to try to educate people about this. Mm-hmm. I think the public was open to it, you know, but the medical community, it's like you learn something in their textbook, it's like, oh, the earth is round, right? And then someone comes along and says, no, the earth is flat. Or we thought that the earth revolved around the sun revolved around the earth, right? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, no, it's actually the other way around. It's like, it's really hard to change your beliefs when you've learned something one way.
What have you learned from this process of policy change?
I've learned that it is messy and slow, and it's hard to get it right the first time, and that there's so many different factors and stakeholders, I think. So it's not just about following the science, but you have to consider feasibility, the public's willingness to hear a message, because if you say something that's not really achievable, people aren't going to bother. You know, it's like, well, I can't do that. I just give up.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's economic considerations, there's political considerations, you know, is it, you know, I realized at one point that, oh, maybe a mask mandate is actually counterproductive because it makes people hate masks so much that, or the enforcement is so onerous, you know, you're asking, it's unfair to ask people to have to enforce this when so many people, you know, vehemently do not want to wear them. I mean, right, there were fights over this, you know, shootings over this. So, you know, at that point, I kind of realized, well, yeah, ideally, we would have a mask mandate and everyone would wear masks. But, you know, in our current social and political setting, maybe that's not the best thing.
And it also seems like, you know, for getting the word out, it became very important to, you know, find the key places where the key people found information, like getting things into medical journals.
Yeah, I realize that you have to kind of get the message to the decision makers or key players kind of in the venues that they use and respect mm-hmm. and look to.
Yeah.
For sure.
But then you had also gone through, like, you know, some journal rejections. So how did you learn from those rejections and figure out how to make sure that your papers got into the journals that you really were trying
yeah,
to...
Yeah, I think it was, you know, my manuscripts get rejected all the time. It's just part of the...
Sure.
Part of science. But, you know, in terms of getting into the medical journals, I think it was important to find an ally, like somebody who was an MD, or, you know, we had an ally who was an editor of one of the journals who kind of respected and believed what we were saying. And so, you know, he was more amenable. That journal was more amenable, and it was a medical journal, was more amenable to publishing, you know, some of these papers. So I would say, yeah, you have to get an ally at some point.
Who's in that community.
Who's in that community, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That makes sense. So it also feels like, you know, you came into the pandemic with some really good communication skills. Like, you had an ability to keep a level head in a very divisive environment. And where did you develop that skill, do you feel like?
Some of it comes from teaching. Like, I think... You know, I care about teaching, and I think I do it well based on feedback I've gotten. And it's really about trying to convey complex subjects to students in a way that links to what they already know and can build on what they already know. So you want to connect with what they already know and then build on that. And explaining it in a way, I think for me, it always helps to visualize things. So I always try to, you know, describe things in a way that people can visualize them. And then also I kind of had a really good role model for this. I did my postdoctoral research at MIT with someone who was a Nobel laureate, and we were doing research in Mexico City, and he was from Mexico, and I could see that people really hung on his every word, you know, because of who he was, and he spoke very carefully. And I observed that when I was in his research group, and you know, tried to adopt that in my own communication during the pandemic, because I realized people were hanging on every word and really making sure that what I said was accurate and also accessible.
Mm-hmm. And what's his name?
That's Mario Molina.
So for those who want to make sure they are following good guidelines for institutions now, where can they go for examples?
There's a lot of good resources now. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has good information about buildings and ventilation and what to do. It's called the Clean Air in Buildings Challenge. There's just a two-page worksheet, I think. And CDC has some really good information now also. You know, I think everything there is good about masks and the importance of good ventilation. And, you know, they've kind of moved down the list, further down the list, hand washing and surface cleaning, for at least for this virus. Those are still important for other diseases. Let's see. WHO has a really good worksheet on ventilation. There's a lot of great resources out there. There's also the Harvard Healthy Schools and Healthy Buildings Program has some excellent guidance documents that are available.
What are some common misconceptions you encounter about airborne transmission of COVID still to this day? And what do you wish more people were aware of? What are misconceptions in this arena that you encounter still that you feel like you're still trying to?
I think there's a lot of people who are still, think that hand washing and distancing are the most important things they can do. I see, for example, someone walking into a building and, you know, using their shirt to open the door, right? But they walk in without a mask. So it's like, oh, I think the priorities here are wrong. Actually, it's more important to wear a mask than to you know, avoid touching the doorknob. So that's the main thing that, you know, a lot of people are still going with and still hearing that message, oh, hand washing surfaces, but really they need to be thinking more about the air we're breathing. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, that's harder because we don't see it. We're not used to thinking about that. The message for that came out much later when people were fatigued, and it wasn't promoted as much. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it seems like there are some just simple things that, you know, I think people also think about, like, well, if I'm going to fix ventilation in my building, that's going to be this huge undertaking.
Yeah.
But there are simple things people can do as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So last week I was traveling and I had a roommate, and one morning I heard her coughing and I was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to get infected with whatever she has. Luckily it wasn't COVID or anything, but still, as soon as I heard that, I cracked open the window. I opened the door to our room so that we could get some airflow through there. That was it. And it would have made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in some of your, you know, interactions with just like, you know, locally, making sure that, you know, the places that were asking you for advice, what were some examples of some advice that you gave to kind of help them make sure that they had good protocols? Or
it was, you know, open windows and doors if you can. Get, you know, if you have the resources, get portable air filtration units, mm-hmm. like HEPA air filtration units. And then, you know, if you can, again, with the ventilation system, if you can adjust it so that the settings and the dampers so that you are bringing in more outdoor air and using less recirculated air in the system, upgrade the filters in those, again, if you can and if the system allows for it. So those were the main things.
And what are you working on now?
We are wrapping up our last paper on SARS-CoV-2. And so that one was where we aerosolized virus, pulled it through masks, different kinds of masks, and looked at how much survived on the masks and how much would transfer to your fingers if you were to touch it. We used artificial skin. And so there's some RNA that does transfer, but we didn't find any infectious virus that transferred to skin. So this idea of touching a contaminated mask maybe, you know, isn't such a big concern. And then we have several large projects going on flu transmission. One of those, so it's called Mitigate Flu, and it's a big interdisciplinary project where we're looking at transmission in daycare centers in Michigan, and then also using some animal models to study transmission under controlled conditions and trying to develop new and better methods of detecting the virus in the air and on surfaces. And then we have another project where we are going to be doing what's called a human challenge study of deliberately infecting people with the flu virus, and then putting them in certain situations with other people who aren't infected to see, you know, how many people get infected. And then finally, we do a lot of work on trying to understand how viruses survive when they're in the environment in droplets or aerosols. And the last thing is that I have a student who is looking at antibiotic resistance, which is another big health problem, and kind of how those microorganisms, kind of bacteria and their genes, are kind of transported through the air.
All right. I think that's everything. Is there anything else you want to make sure our readership knows?
No, we covered a lot. So
yeah,
that's it. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you to Lindsay Marr for joining American Scientist Podcast. Read more in the September-October issue of American Scientist. You've been listening to a podcast by American Scientist, published by Sigma Psi, the Scientific Research Honor Society. I'm Katie L. Burke, Digital Features Editor.